Hello, everyone. I'm Drew.
I'm Bailey.
I'm Lacey.
And we have a special guest.
I'm Pat.
We're sarcastic, so let's get sinister.
I feel like you should have finished the theme before introducing him.
Hi, I'm Pat. I liked it.
He didn't know the flow.
I mean, he did great. I did want to mention real quick that he's usually in the background of our episodes.
Yeah, he's actually just now like fully part of it, though.
Yeah, he's now paying attention. Mm-hmm. Is he helping you with the puzzle?
No.
Oh, he's just sitting.
It's not an opportunity right now for him to help me with the puzzle.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
Some puzzles have to be solo puzzles.
I prefer solo puzzles. Have you seen those puzzle competitions?
No, but that sounds amazing.
No, is it like a speed competition?
Yes. So what it is I believe that you can have like teams. And for example, there's like 20 tables. Everybody gets the same puzzle. It's like, it's not... The pieces are still in the plastic. And then, so when it goes ready, set, go, you have to open the box, rip open the puzzle pieces, and then you start doing the puzzle. And the first one done wins.
I don't know if I would actually like that. I need to be able to walk away from my puzzle sometimes.
Oh, I just think it's very stressful.
Sounds a little stressful.
And I think you need to have the right puzzling partners. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it could get very animal. Yeah.
Imagine the fights.
Yes. Yeah.
Bailey. I can't thought if Bailey would be a good puzzle partner or an awful puzzle partner.
I feel like if we had, like, if it was us three on the team, if we had, like, a set plan where it's like, okay, Bailey, you work on that. You, like, everybody takes, like, a corner or something.
Mm-hmm.
Or, like, Bailey's like, I'm going to take all the white pieces. And I say, I'm going to take all the blue ones. And Lacey, you work on the
outside. I'm comfortable on the outside of a puzzle.
Border?
Yes.
Yeah, the border.
The outside.
It's not the inside. Puzzled?
Well, I was going to call it the frame.
Also not wrong.
Heavy sigh from Bailey.
I'm not sure if she would be a good puzzle partner.
Well, I think the trick is, Lacey, with my plan.
Puzzle partner.
The trick is that Bailey is focused on her thing and she's not paying attention to what you're fucking up.
Yes. We'd have to do practice runs to figure out the best way to cooperate.
Obviously, we would train. Yes. We're not just going to go in there raw dogging it.
Yeah,
okay?
Let's just go in there cold and see how we do.
Ooh, amateurs, let's go.
When I say that it's like, oh gosh, the people are so, like, I mean, there are some like groups that are just like old ladies who are just like, we're here for fun. And then there are other people who are like, I don't know, punching each other.
Why are they doing that?
Because it's intense.
You're such a good storyteller.
Speaking of storytelling.
Oh,
segway.
Don't
we
have news actually today? Though, yeah. Before we jump in, I did want to mention that something something new has happened.
Ooh,
tell us.
So,
Luigi, because I'm enjoying a lot of the memes about him.
No, it's not about Luigi. It's about Gilgo Beach Killer.
Oh, less fun.
Rex Huerman. He has been charged with his seventh murder.
Nice.
As some of you may recall from episode 49, published October 22nd, 2023. So over a year ago. Wow. 11 bodies were found on Long Island over a period of months in 2010 and 2011. Authorities were able to tie six of the victims to Rex, but just recently they were able to tie him to the death of Valerie Mack. A hair linked to the wife or daughter of suspect Rex was found near the left wrist of 21-year-old victim Valerie Mack, according to the court documents. Valerie's remains were found on Long Island in 2000. She had been working as an escort in Philadelphia and was last seen by her family that year in New Jersey.
Go Birds. Sorry.
I'm okay.
You said Philly.
I know. But hold on. Can we just talk about, like we're killing it. Like,
we're not going to jinx anything. What are we doing?
I've been, like every time they, like, I tell, when they play, I say to Lou, I'm like,
when we're talking about murder?
Huh?
You said Go Birds.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know what I said it.
Yeah, it's
just... I have to say, I haven't caught a single game this season because I used to watch on Hulu Live and then because I would just switch over to Live for football season and I won't anymore because it's like $90 a month and I've just been really lazy about figuring out where to watch it. And part of me is like,
you're the problem.
Don't you dare watch.
So at this point in the season, I'm like, I've listened because I'll put the radio on and listen to it, but I haven't like watched a game. So I'm gonna continue that.
If we lose, I will literally text you first, being like, "You fucking
are you watching?"
I have the NFL app, and it sends me like updates every time there's a scoring play or really anything.
I pay extra to watch it.
Once we're into Super Bowl time, regardless of who's in, I'll pay to watch the Super Bowl.
Oh,
you don't sound like a true fan.
Yeah.
Well, but is she a true
winning because of
her? Yeah, for not watching because they're winning.
I forgot Pat was here.
For the record, Pat is off camera for anybody. All right, so are we ready to get started?
I'm ready.
Do we not want to talk about Luigi anymore?
I mean, what's there to talk about?
A lot of my coworkers are like pretty much in love with him.
Okay.
Yeah. So cute.
Okay.
I learned...
Also your husband.
So he's not being charged with terrorism, but he's being charged with, like, first-degree murder.
Which also isn't good.
Right, but, like...
Still not something you want to be charged with.
What I learned is that New York, in order to be charged with first-degree murder, you have to meet one of, like, 12 things. And I guess he meets the terrorism one or something. I don't know. Oh, I can send you the link if you're interested in the legalese. No,
you do it.
No.
But you know about
Colleen Ritzer.
Okay. We'll talk about
it. So, I mentioned earlier that this one kind of got past my little wall that I keep separating my emotions from like work stuff. And I think it's because this is just there's no point to what happened to her. Mm-hmm. And also I wanted to tell you guys this because I wanted to make Lacey feel even more unsafe in her line of work.
Oh, good.
Yes.
She's a teacher.
So, huh?
Colleen's a teacher, I assume?
Yes.
Mm.
So...
Oh! I think I know what one you're doing. I think you hinted it before or something.
I'm sure you know what I'm going to be doing. So Colleen Elizabeth Ritzer was born in Lawrence, Massachusetts on May 13th, 1989 to Thomas and Peggy Ritzer. Little fun fact, remember Thelma Todd that we talked about last week?
Yeah.
Where was she born? Lawrence, Massachusetts.
Lawrence, Massachusetts, yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
I should know that because that was my case.
Yeah.
She was only a couple years older than me. I don't love that either.
Yeah.
Lacey, there's a lot of people that are a couple years older than you.
I don't learn about all of their murders.
If we're going to, like, really nitpick.
That's true. That'll make me feel better, actually.
I mean...
There's so many people born in 1989.
Like, and also, like, Michael Jackson is, like, a few years older than you, or was a few years older than you. Like, we could say that.
I feel offended by that. I'm not... I can't explain why.
Oh,
how old was he?
Okay, I'm going to move on. Colleen was one of three children.
She's 50.
Sharing her parents with her brother Daniel and her sister Laura.
It's a weird
You
said sharing her parents?
Yeah, she shared. She was a good person.
Interesting sentence. You just
not everybody wants to share.
You threw me off. When Colleen was 3, she was inspired by her preschool teacher. She wanted to help others and open their minds. That's when she knew she wanted to be a teacher.
Lacey, when did you know you wanted to be a teacher?
I don't know. I think I kind of always gravitated that way, but I didn't decide for sure until high school. My mom pushed me at teaching since like elementary school, but I was like, no, not for me.
And here we are. Why did she want you to be a teacher?
She just thought that I would be good at it.
Huh.
Apparently I liked to help other kids, which I think means I was bossy. And she was like, natural teacher.
Yeah, I don't... You don't give off bossy vibes.
Yeah, I've gotten...
She's burned out by now. She went through all of middle school bossing around her peers. She's tired. Yeah.
I was gonna say, she hasn't really ever bossed me around.
Well,
you know, and I wouldn't.
Dominant personality, Drew.
I feared you since the beginning. I think we knew that.
Oh, Lacey. Okay, so she graduated from Andover High School in 2007. Then she got her bachelor's degree from Assumption College in Worcester in 2011. She began her teaching career at Hale Middle School in Stowe. She taught there for a year before getting a job teaching math at Danvers High School, located 25 miles north of Boston. At the same time, she was pursuing a graduate degree at Salem State College. Colleen enjoyed spending time with her family, vacationing, cruising, shopping, and making collages. But her favorite hobby and passion was teaching. She liked thinking up unique and creative ways to inspire and teach. Her motto was, every day may not be good, but there is something good in every day.
It's a good motto.
Yeah, this is why she's gonna die. She was too positive.
Oh, I was gonna say, she's just like Lacey. Going to graduate school.
Full of possibilities.
I need to start being more negative.
Today's a shooting day.
There you go. On Monday, October 28th, 2013, the church where Colleen's family worshipped, St. Augustine Church, was filled with mourners. About 400 Danvers High School students were among the estimated 1,000 people who gathered to pay final respects. Pink flowers decorated the outside of the church, and many attendants wore pink clothing as a tribute to the deceased. Switching gears, Philip Chisholm was 14 years old at the time, having been born January 21st, 1999, in Tennessee. His parents, Stacy and Diana Chisholm, were married in September 1998, only 4 months before he was born. The following year, in April 2000, Diana gave birth to their second child, Isabella. Philip's childhood was described as tumultuous. In March 2001, Diana filed for divorce, complaining that Stacy had been guilty of inappropriate marital conduct. She cited a section of Tennessee law that says couples may divorce if the husband or wife is guilty of such cruel and inhuman treatment or conduct towards the spouse as renders cohabitation unsafe and improper.
Hmm. So she was abusive?
He was abusive.
Oh, sorry.
Stacy is a man.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay. The documents showed that Chisholm's father agreed during the separation to have restricted time with his son, who was then 2, because of prior physical and emotional abuse, as well as alcohol abuse.
I feel like prior physical abuse means he should have gotten no time with his son, not just like limited time with his son.
Yeah.
I feel like if you have prior history of abuse, you don't get time with the children.
But did he get like supervision?
Was it abuse against the 2-year-old, though?
I don't care. I think the supervision question is valid, too. I guess if it was, like, supervised visitation, then it's harder.
From the divorce...
new stuff.
The divorce did not go through, and the two reconciled in June 2001. But just because they reconciled doesn't mean everything was perfect. Stacy allegedly cheated on Diana often. According to Diana's friend, Claudia Rodriguez, at one point around 2008, after Stacy had cheated on Diana yet again, the family moved in with Rodriguez before moving to Florida near Diana's parents.
He sounds amazing. Family re-
hmm?
You said he sounds amazing.
Mm-hmm. The family returned to Tennessee about a year later in 2009, moving back in with Claudia. Philip was a typical, sometimes moody preteen at the time. He shared a single room in Claudia's home with his mother and sister. I saw in some reports that he has two sisters. I could only find the name of one of them, so I don't know. But either way, he shared one room with his mom and his at least one sister.
At least one sister.
In the summer of 2013, Philip moved to Danvers, Massachusetts, and enrolled at Danvers High School as a freshman. What grade do you teach, Lacey?
I have 9, 10, and 11 this year.
Oh, so freshmen. Cool.
Yes.
Philip tried out for JV soccer, and his fellow students said that he seemed mostly friendly. But a few weeks into the semester, they noticed he'd quieted down. By mid-October, his teammates noticed that he... Huh?
Maybe he just settled in.
Maybe. By mid-October, his teammates noticed that he wasn't even celebrating goals anymore. Like soccer goals.
I mean, when you get like 5, it's kind of like, oh.
Okay.
Again.
He was on JV, so.
I mean, they still play.
Yeah, I know, but it's just like, he's not varsity. I'm like, not doing great.
In 9th grade! I think it's really extreme if a 9th grader is able to get on varsity.
He had become increasingly withdrawn. On Tuesday, October 22nd, 2013, Philip didn't return home from after school. His mother reported him missing to the police. A picture of Philip was disseminated by the Danvers Police Department via Twitter and Facebook posts. Danvers residents all received a reverse 911 call. At around the same time,
Bailey. It's a reverse 911 call.
I think that everybody gets a phone call and it's like an automated message that says, hey, keep an eye out.
Oh.
Yeah.
Either that or you know how we get like text messages?
Sure.
Something like that. Everybody got notified.
Everybody was put on the BOLO.
Mm-hmm. At around the same time, Colleen's parents also called the police. Colleen also had not returned home after school. And that was very unlike Colleen. Colleen's routine was to stay late after school to do some work or offer assistance to students. She'd return home in the evening and go straight to her mother's office to chat about their days. Colleen always called if there was going to be a deviation in the typical routine, but Colleen did not call and she did not come home, so she too was reported missing. Meanwhile, Topsfield police officer Neil Hovey was preparing for his midnight to 8 a.m. shift when he received a report about a missing Danvers teenager. Topsfield borders Danvers to the north.
Okay.
Hovey, who is now Chief Hovey. Oh, that was cool. Like, he got promoted. Go for him. Told his dispatch that he intended to check the area near the border for the missing teen. In response, his dispatcher told him something that led Hovey to believe that Philip had taken his own life. I don't know exactly what was said that made him feel like that, but later on I have a guess, and I'll bring it up again.
Okay.
Dispatcher Larry Nestor called the Topsfield Police Station to report having seen a black male walking on Old Route 1 on the highway close to the tree line. It just so happens that the Topsfield Police Station is located on this road, almost 5 miles north of Danvers High School. At midnight on October 23rd, Officer Hovey went to the location that Nestor had reported. Approximately a quarter of a mile south of the police station, Hovey saw an individual walking north on the southbound lane. The road was dark with no streetlights in the area, and for several reasons, Officer Hovey felt that this area was dangerous for someone to just be walking along. In addition to the lack of light, the individual was also on a little bridge where there was a smaller shoulder. The speed limit was 45, and there was a hill that created an obstructed view of the road. So he was like, it's not safe for this person to be walking here. I found a place where I think, like, I went to, on Google Maps, I went to the Tossfield Police Department, and I started going south until I found this little bridge. And it is about the distance that he reported it was. So I think that this is the area where they found the individual. Hovey pulled into the middle of the road, turned on his lights, and parked at around 12:28. Hovey exited his cruiser and approached the individual. He was wearing shorts, a zip-up sweatshirt, black knee-high socks, and sneakers. Being that it was late October in Massachusetts, the clothing seemed inappropriate for the temperature. It had been in the 50s. I went back and checked, yeah. Hovey asked the individual where they were going. Nowhere, was the response. Hovey asked where the individual was coming from. Tennessee, was the response. So we know now that this was Philip Chisholm. But at the time, Officer Hovey believed the individual to be in his late teens, early 20s. And not 14, which is what Philip was. During their exchange, Philip did not make eye contact at all with Hovey, looking straight ahead the entire time. He kept his hands in his sweatshirt pockets, and he was carrying a backpack. Officer Hovey asked Philip where he lived. He responded that he had no address and had been walking for days. Hovey did not think that Philip looked disheveled, and because of the lighting, Hovey couldn't determine if he had any concealed weapons. Hovey performed a pat and frisk on Philip. In the left front pocket, he found a hard piece of plastic, which he believed to be an ID or a credit card. In the right front pocket, Hovey found a 2-inch smooth, hard, oblong object. Officer D. Bernardo arrived as backup and requested Philip take his hands out of his pockets, which I feel like should have been done earlier.
Like, for someone, but you didn't ask them to, like, put their hands up?
Yeah.
Okay. Like,
he took note that he couldn't tell if he had any concealed weapons, but was like, you keep your hands where they are. Officer D. Bernardo asked what Philip had in his backpack. Philip responded, survival gear. So D. Bernardo then took the backpack. The officers escorted Philip off the road and over to their parked cars. Hovey instructed Philip to empty his pockets onto the trunk of the cruiser. He removed a rock, a driver's license, an insurance card, and credit cards. But none of those items were in Philip's name. They all held the name Colleen Ritzer. At this time, the officers were unaware that she was also reported missing. It was at this time when the officers asked Philip to identify himself. They were elated to have found the missing teen. They were like, hey, we did it. Lacey's muted, and I don't know why, but I feel like...
I feel like she's nervous.
You don't hear my gasping.
I want to.
Oh, it also didn't help. Unmuted. We're like, hey, Lacey, what grade do you teach? Oh, great.
I know, I'm really laying it on thick.
Jeez.
Well, she's already said that she's going to be meaner, so I think that should help.
Oh, I mean,
come and goes.
So, at 12:35, Hovey called Danvers PD to report they'd found Philip Chisholm. After informing the Danvers PD, the two officers continued questioning Philip. They'd asked where he'd gotten Colleen's cards. Philip first said that he found them at the Stop and Shop. But the officers were like, where? Or like, which one? Because there wasn't a Stop and Shop in Topsfield. So then Philip was like, he said he didn't know, but then was like, he got them from her car.
Okay.
So the officers transported Philip to their station, and they arrived there at 12:41. Officer Hovey asked if there was anything dangerous in the backpack, and Philip responded, yes. So Hovey began to search it. The first item he removed was a purse containing numerous items, including female underwear. Also inside the purse was a box cutter with a protruding blade. Officer Hovey observed a red-brown substance covering most of the box cutter. He asked, whose blood is this? And Philip responded, it's the girl's.
How freaked out do you think the cops are at this point? And like, I feel like it just started as him stopping somebody who was walking along, and you think they're just getting increasingly like, what the fuck have we found here?
Well, so even like, even more to your point, Lacey, apparently they make a habit of stopping people on this road because it's so dangerous. Like, they often stop, whenever they see someone, they stop and offer them a ride. So, like, it started off being so not a big deal.
Yeah, just
and then it was like, thing. Oh, we found a missing teen. And then it was like, why does he have what bloody box cutter?
Yeah.
So at 12:50, Officer Hovey stepped away to answer a call from Captain Patrick Ambrose from the Danvers PD. Meanwhile, Officer DiBernardo asked Philip if he knew where the girl was. Philip responded, she's buried in the woods. Officer D.
Being very forthcoming.
I know. I don't know. I have thoughts. I don't know, like, what his... I don't know.
Did he just not kill her?
I don't know. Like, it seems like he tried to, like, cover his tracks. But then he's being very forthcoming. Like, he's not, like, lying. I don't know.
Well, he's also, what, like, 14? Because he's in ninth grade, so, like...
Well, it's like Tom Segura said when he watches like 48 hours and the people just start confessing and he's like, dude, lie for longer. You can stab somebody, but you can't lie for 20 minutes about it?
Not on.
Yeah, but like, is it even admissible because his parents aren't there and he's under 18?
So
if you think he said, would possibly just be like thrown out.
That gets brought up later.
Are you reading ahead?
I had the spark notes.
Good job, guest.
Again. I'm sorry, Drew. This is so embarrassing.
It's off-putting.
It's really rude.
Yeah. So she's buried in the woods. Dr. DiBernardo then asked if they could still help her. Like, if we found her, can we still help her? And Philip said no. So at approximately 12:56 a.m., I'm just going to call him Officer D. Officer D read Philip his Miranda rights. When asked if he understood, Philip confirmed. When asked if he wanted to speak to Officer D, Philip said he did. He then signed the form confirming that he understood and he was willing to speak to them. It was noted that Philip had brown reddish stains on the sleeves of his sweatshirt and a ski mask that he was wearing around his neck.
They just noticed that.
Well, I think that they noticed it before, but they took note of it.
Okay.
Officer D seized some of the teen's clothing and his sneakers. Meanwhile, so back to Officer Hovey, who is on the phone. What he's taught, like, he got a phone call from the captain from Danvers PD, and what the captain is saying is the state police are coming to get Philip, and stop talking to him. So, members of the Massachusetts State Police, including Sergeant O'Connor, arrived at 1:40 a.m. Philip had spent the hour sitting on a bench, uncuffed, just waiting. Upon their arrival, Hovey informed Sergeant O'Connor of the details of the interactions with the teen. Sergeant O'Connor then asked Officer D to place Philip in handcuffs. So, what did Massachusetts State Police know that the Topsfield PD didn't? And why were they even involved? It was a missing kid, right?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
So, let's back up. On the evening of October 22nd, 2013, we learned what Topsfield PD was doing. Let's find out about Danvers PD. Officer Baldessari was assigned to Danvers High School as the student resource officer. At around 10:30 p.m., he'd gone to the high school to review video surveillance in hopes of uncovering some clues. Upon his arrival, he spoke to Carolyn Quigley on the phone. She was a parent of a student And she told him that at 3 p.m., she'd seen someone she thought was Philip changing his clothing outside the school by the student parking lot. After the phone call, Principal Susan Ambrosevich told Officer Baldessari that Colleen Ritzer was also missing. Baldessari delegated the task of following up on Mrs. Quigley's report to Officer Stephanie Wennerberg. She checked the exterior of the building near the student lot while Baldessari went to his office to check the footage. So video surveillance had just recently been installed at the high school. Hundreds of cameras were installed around the school, but because it was such a new system, the computer was having trouble, like, loading. So Baldessari had to reboot the computer. And while he waited, he decided to go to the wooded area near the student parking lot to meet up with Officer Wennerberg and Captain Ambrose. Upon his arrival, Officer Wennerberg informed him that Colleen's bag, a recycling bin, some shoes and clothing, as well as other items belonging to Colleen, were found in some brush near the cross-country trail near the student lot. There appeared to be blood inside the recycling bin. Wennerberg also informed them that she'd found blood in the second floor women's bathroom. It was now shortly after 11 p.m. So, backing up, this is about the time when Officer Hovey from Topsfield would have been communicating with his dispatcher and was like, hey, I'm going to go check the border to find the teen. Mm-hmm. And the dispatcher was like, he may have committed suicide. So my guess is that the dispatcher, all he knew was there was a missing teen and they found blood.
Ah.
Still seems like a pretty large jump there to make, but whatever. Okay, so that's the picture where they found blood. Not much. And then here's a picture of the woods where they found. So, this is a backpack. This is a bag. I don't know what's over here, but yeah, so you can see there's just stuff thrown here. And there's the recycling bin. At 11:15, while still in the parking lot, Baldessari received a phone call from former student Joseph Mello. He just told Baldessari that he'd seen Philip earlier in the day at the high school. It didn't seem very pertinent, but I figured, you know, why not mention it? It takes 2 seconds. At 11:45, Danvers Police Sergeant Philip Tanzi arrived at the high school. He instructed Baldessari to go view the security footage. So while watching the footage, several observations were made. So it's a 12-minute video. I don't feel like showing it to you guys.
Thank you.
But I did take screenshots of the things that I felt were most important.
Okay.
If any of our listeners want to go watch it, it's 12 minutes. It's on YouTube. It's, you know, super available.
Sign up for our Patreon to watch it with
you. Yeah, or you could just get the cliff notes by signing up for our Patreon. Ha ha. Ha ha. So the first thing, or the first note, the first, like, notice of Colleen is at 2:30 p.m. Colleen is seen talking in the hallway with another teacher.
Is she on the left or right? Because they dressed to match this day.
Yes. So what it is it was Buddy Day.
Oh,
okay.
And so she and this other math teacher were buddies, and they dressed like twins.
Aww.
Yes. I believe she is the one facing us.
Okay.
So at 12:54, and I'm going to just in this little segment, I'm just going to mention seconds because I think it's just interesting. At 2:54:20, Colleen left her classroom and started walking down the hall. At 2:54:26, so 6 seconds later, a male exits the same classroom wearing jeans, a white t-shirt, and a blue zip-up hoodie. He looks up and down the hallway before going back into the classroom after 12 seconds. Right away, Officer Baldessari recognized the male as being Philip Chisholm. So from now on, I'm just going to call him male, but they know it's Philip. So at 2:54:34, so 14 seconds after she left her classroom, Colleen entered the second floor women's bathroom. At 2:54:41, male exits the classroom wearing jeans, a blue zip-up hoodie, but now he's got his hood up over his head. He walks down the hallway in the same direction as Colleen. At 53 seconds, the male is seen walking down the hallway, same direction as Colleen, but it appears he is he's pulled rubber gloves out of his pocket, and he begins to put them on. At 2:55:06, he enters the second floor women's bathroom, and he's still putting the gloves on. At 3:06, another female student enters the bathroom, but quickly exits after a few seconds, or after 7 seconds. At 3:07, the male exits the bathroom and begins walking down the hall. His hood is still up, gloves are removed, and he is carrying something that appears to be what I first thought was a trash bag or a belt, but later it turns out it's a pair of pants. He exits the school at 3:08. And then just in that time, I took this picture because you can clearly see him looking down at his hand. And in the next shot, his hand looks awfully red, doesn't it?
Oh my God. That's disturbing.
So he leaves the school at 3:08. 2 minutes later, he re-enters. You can see him there. Without the blue hoodie on. He begins to jog down the hall. He returns to the classroom. And a minute later, exits with his hands full. He is carrying a backpack in his right hand, a smaller bag in his left. He has a large shoulder bag over his right shoulder, and he has a red sweatshirt draped over his head.
I'm not trying to blame this on anybody but him, but I am like, where are any other people in this school?
So we'll get to it. If you were to watch the 12-minute video, you would see him. He walks by other teachers, but like the class day ended at 1:55.
Oh, so it wasn't during. Yeah, okay. I wasn't really thinking. So it was
35 minutes after the end of the school day. But he does interact with other people. I mean, that girl did walk into the bathroom, but quickly leave.
Mm-hmm.
He in the security video, he does walk by another teacher who's like, she's got her bags, she's leaving.
Yeah.
And then there's an interaction later on with another student. But like, this is the thing I'm talking about. He's covering up his head, but like,
we've already seen him.
Yeah. A lot.
And then, later he's just like talking about it.
Yeah. So he goes into the stairwell. He goes down this little flight of stairs right in front of him and disappears around the corner, but quickly, like a minute later, he comes back up the stairs, but he's not carrying any bags. He removes a sweater from over his head, revealing he's wearing a ski mask now. He puts the sweatshirt on, removes the mask, and begins jogging down the hallway again. This is thought to be because he's having an exchange with this student. So this is him walking towards the bathroom, the women's second floor bathroom, but then this is him turning around and going back. And then he's like, at the beginning of this, he's like talking to this guy, but then he starts running away. And this guy's just like, what the fuck are you doing? At 3:15, the male is seen walking down the hallway, pulling a recycling bin. And just take note, he's using one hand and he doesn't seem to be struggling. He enters the women's bathroom. 7 minutes later, he exits the bathroom, pulling the recycling bin, now with two hands. He has removed the red sweatshirt and has put the ski mask back on. Cameras capture him walking the recycling bin outside, down the sidewalk, and through the parking lot, walking in the direction of the cross-country trail. So, like, he walks by this guy. And then you can kind of see him right here. He's walking towards the trail there. At
you may not trust anyone with a trash bag.
Yeah. At 3:30, he's seen returning with the bin, walking back through the parking lot. 28 minutes later, he's seen walking through the parking lot, now without the bin. He's barefoot now, and he enters the school, and it appears he has red stains on his jeans. Can you see the red stains?
Yeah.
He goes to his locker in the hallway and then goes into the men's bathroom with a bag. He exits the bathroom and is in a completely new outfit. He's wearing shorts and a black hoodie. He's got the bag on his back and he's carrying a pen, a water bottle, and what appears to be his previous clothing. He's still barefoot. And then he's seen going to the women's bathroom again. He exits very quickly. And then he leaves the school. 14 minutes later, he's seen in the parking lot. He originally stopped behind this little section here and is bending over. And then when he walks through, he seems to have put on shoes. At 4:24, he re-enters the school and he just kind of strolls the hallway. And he actually, at this time, I noticed that he's actually carrying two drawstring bags, a red one and a white one. And then he finally leaves the school for good at 4:31 p.m. So, like 2 hours after he left the classroom, he's finally leaving the school. So, by the time Officer Baldessori had finished watching all the footage, it was 2:30 a.m. He called Detective Robert Sullivan at the station and informed him that about all the content in the surveillance video. Sullivan relayed the information to troopers who were actively interrogating Philip. So, backing up a little bit, because we kind of just jumped from when Baldessori was sent to watch the footage to 2:30 a.m. So, after Baldessori left to go watch the cameras at 12:45, Massachusetts State Trooper Bucheri arrived at the school at 12:30. He met up with the officers in the wooded area near the trail, and he observed the blood in the bin. He observed clothes suspended on some brush with blood stains and a pair of sneakers. Bucheri searched the woods with a flashlight and noted a pair of stained gloves. He called Detective Lieutenant Norman Zuck, who was his commanding officer, and he briefed him on his observations. Zuck, Tansy, and Bucheri all met up at the Danvers PD, where they spoke to Captain Ambrose, who then called Topsfield PD and told Hovey not to question Philip. So, now we know what was kind of happening at either time. Like, by the time that they told the officers, don't talk to him, that's all that they had found. And they had also not been aware at the time of the surveillance footage. They just found bloody gloves and all the stuff in the woods. At that time, the sergeant called Diana Chisholm and asked her to meet at the station. She arrived at 1:45 a.m. and she started being interviewed. She expressed disbelief that Philip could harm someone. She said Philip didn't have a record of violence, but that he was capable of snapping due to stress over his parents' separation, the move from Tennessee to Massachusetts, and his family history of mental illness. She said, quote, anybody is capable of snapping under stressful situations. Please don't tell me someone is dead. I'm going to pass out.
Oh. I feel like it's one thing to be like, he can snap when he's angry. And then to follow up with, and did he kill somebody? Like, that's,
yeah.
That feels like you have some suspicions about how far you think he would go.
Like, yeah.
Not even just like, did he hurt anyone? Like, straight to like, did he kill someone?
Yeah, did he get like not did he get in a fight or anything? It was
I feel like the whole snapping under stressful situations, and then you're like the separation and the move and everything, that doesn't feel like a snap, like that's ongoing stuff.
It also seems like she's like just by that phrase, like it feels like she like is constantly making an excuse for him.
Justifying.
Yeah, I will say though that out of all of Philip's family members, she doesn't suck as much as everyone else. Okay.
That's something.
That sounds promising.
Yeah. So while she was being interviewed, Sergeant O'Connor, who'd gone to pick up Philip, called Zuck and informed him about the contents found in Philip's backpack, as well as the comments he made, i.e., the girl, and no, she couldn't be helped. So Zuck, who is he's the commanding officer of the troopers, and so I think he's probably like the head guy. He believed Colleen had been murdered, but because of the amount of volume that they'd found at the scene, they couldn't definitively say someone has died. Like there wasn't a lot of blood that they'd found. So at 2 a.m., the forensics team from Massachusetts State Police arrived at the school and began documenting everything. At the same time, Philip arrived at Danvers Police Station, and he and his mother were taken into an interview room together. They were left alone to speak privately before the trooper and sergeant began to interview Philip at 2:30 a.m. It was during this interview that Baldessari finally finished the videotapes and informed Sullivan, who kept the trooper informed during the interview. He provided like he would come in and like give him like clips from the video and like Google Maps and shit. They interviewed Philip for an hour and 44 minutes. During the interview, the trooper and sergeant were polite and patient. They noted that Philip avoided looking at and interacting with his mother. At first, Diana insisted on getting a lawyer, but then Philip told Philip, if you want to talk, you can talk. Philip asked the investigators if he had to talk while she was in the room. Diana offered to leave, and Philip responded, then leave. I don't know why you're here. Diana told him, I'm here because I love you. Philip said, I don't care.
Bye.
Diana
I'm leaving.
said, you do care. To which Philip responded, just go. So during that entire exchange, Philip would not look at her. So I think that says something about his psyche.
So he just like trying to like kill his mother, but used.
It just seems like he's got something against his mom first, like, but was it seems out of the blue. Anyway.
Yeah, there had never been, as far as we know, I'm assuming, any violence from him against her.
No, I mean, she's the one who like has him. So I don't
Yeah.
know.
Maybe she's
After
like
Diana left,
or
Philip.
something and is making life hard.
Yeah. After Diana left, Philip began making eye contact with investigators for the first time. He told the investigators that very bad things happened to Colleen because she had used a trigger word. Despite their attempts, Philip refused to divulge what the trigger word was. Throughout the interview, Philip basically didn't deny anything. He drew three different diagrams. One was a map of the high school with an area marked body. One was a map to where Philip said he smashed his and Colleen's cell phones. And the last one was a diagram of Colleen's body. So this last diagram indicated that there were stab wounds to her neck. He told investigators that he knew all 206 meridians and pressure points. I don't know what that means.
I don't think he knew what that means.
I googled meridians. It seems like it's like a thing for acupuncture, but I couldn't find anything that said 269. The most I saw was like 12. So I don't know. I don't
I definitely know all the meridians, bro.
know.
The girls
Then
love it.
he graphically described cutting an artery in Colleen's throat. He said, quote, the way it works is it's kind of like a dragon's kiss. the blood all rushes up. And so when I hit it, it's a lot. It's more than a lot of blood. So during the interview, Philip indicated that he'd cut Colleen twice and described the attack in such a way that was inconsistent with the evidence. Based on what he said, there should have been much more blood in the bathroom. He also indicated during the interview premeditation and a plan to stay out in the woods to avoid capture. But then he also said he wanted to get caught and go to juvie. But then later he again spoke about his plan to escape to Canada via a bridge and a ferry. The bridge to Canada. You know the one.
Like Bridge to Terabithia, but weird.
So over the place, oh my god. Mm-hmm.
He also claimed during the interview that he had blacked out, but, quote, after she insulted me, that's when I became the teacher.
Okay.
It was, like, he was just waiting for a chance to hurt somebody.
It seems like he's just waiting for a chance to use that sentence. He probably was thinking about that for the hours he was gone.
Like, I genuinely hated him after I read that. I was like, oh my god, you are such a, like, a loser.
Like, what a nerd. A creative writing class or something, for the love of god.
He said he disliked people who tried to help him, that he doesn't really have a sense of morals, and he took Colleen's pants off to humiliate her. So, a real piece of shit.
Okay, great.
I keep reminding myself that he's only 14, and I don't know why, because that only makes it creepier.
Yeah. While Philip was being interviewed, the cavalry was called. A canine search was ordered. The Danvers Fire Department was called in to use thermal imaging. MSP Air Wing was requested. Additional officers were called in early for their shifts, and EMTs were dispatched to the high school. Danvers PD were also trying to track Colleen and Philip's cell phones. So, like, they were like, we need to find her. Let's get everybody. The air wing of the Massachusetts State Police and the Danvers Fire Department used infrared technology to attempt to locate Colleen without success. Cadaver and tracking canines were also unsuccessful. Philip's phone company was able to track the location of his phone. It was found near the Hollywood Hits Theater, where investigators learned the teen had bought a movie ticket, but then left.
So, like, alibi.
Well, I think more of just, like, he uses Colleen's credit card to buy the ticket. So I think it was more of, like, I have a credit card. I can buy stuff with it. But once Philip had provided enough information, Lieutenant Michael Holleran with MSP began walking down a path and noticed disturbed dirt on the ground. He grabbed a light and some other officials from the crime scene services section of the MSP. Once back in the area, one of the crime scene people, Emily Despress, noticed a toe emerging from a pile of leaves. They had found Colleen.
Hmm.
So, trigger warning.
All right.
Colleen's body was hidden with leaves and debris, but once uncovered, they could clearly see a very deep wound to her throat. EMTs arrived to confirm death. It was around 3 a.m. Colleen was found naked from the waist down with her bra pulled up. A stick was removed from her groin area by Lieutenant Holleran. Her body was only about 6 to 12 inches away from where they'd found the stained white gloves. And near her body, a note reading, "I hate you all," was found. During the autopsy, sperm found inside Colleen was consistent with Philip Chisholm's DNA. It wasn't a match, but it was consistent. The 16 stab wounds. Did you hear that?
Too many.
Were they all at her neck?
The 16 stab wounds to Colleen's neck were not frenzied. They appeared calculated. Wound D, so named by the prosecution, was the deepest and most fatal. It was actually a series of cuts made to sever her carotid, cut through her trachea, her esophagus, and it nicked her vertebrae. After speaking to witnesses, police were able to piece together the entire day. On October 22nd, the school day ended at 1:55 p.m. Colleen was in her classroom with Philip and another student. Oh, here, I have another picture. That's where they found her. So there's like a fence here. I don't know if you can see the poles.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And then that's... So Colleen was in her classroom with Philip and another student. The other student told police that Colleen asked Philip about Tennessee, and at that time he became visibly upset. Colleen noticed and quickly changed the subject.
That was the trigger, her trying to talk to him about his life.
She said the trigger word. It was Tennessee. Police spoke to the teacher Colleen had been speaking to in the hallway moments before she was murdered. Her name was Sarah Giaquinta. She was another math teacher at the school, and she and Colleen had been dressed as twins for Buddy Day. Sarah had peeked in on Colleen and saw Philip in the classroom. While in the hallway talking, Colleen told Sarah, "I don't know why he's here," referring to why Philip was hanging out after school in her room. The security footage tells of how Colleen went to the bathroom and Philip followed her. What happened in the bathroom is unclear. Philip said he knocked Colleen out and cut her neck from behind. But during the trial, the prosecutor told the jury that Colleen was asphyxiated to incapacitate her. While in the bathroom, Chisholm then raped her. The student named Danielle, who had walked into the bathroom but quickly turned around, told police that she got a glimpse of someone partially unclothed and a pile of clothing on the floor. She thought she had just interrupted someone getting dressed, so that's why she quickly exited. Hmm. The prosecution believes that this interruption caused Philip to move his victim to the woods. So I guess at that time he realized, oh shit, I'm in a bathroom.
People around, yeah.
Yeah. Philip exited the bathroom and building to discard Colleen's pants and his bloody clothing. This is when Carolyn Quigley noticed him, the parent who had called the officer earlier. He returned to the classroom and removed his and Colleen's belongings. He put the bags in the recycling bins that were located right around this corner here. As he was returning to the bathroom, he ran into another classmate named Ramsey. The prosecution asserted that he had intended on returning to the bathroom, but couldn't because Ramsey was there. Ramsey would question why he was going into the girls' bathroom, and Chisholm knew that Colleen was not dead at the time and could have called out or crawled out, so Ramsey needed to be led away. Because he ran into another student, this is why Philip had removed the ski mask after having just put it on. Once Ramsey was no longer a threat, Chisholm returned to the bathroom with the recycling bin. He put an incapacitated Colleen in the bin, then wheeled her out to the woods to finish his assault and murder. He first walks in one direction, trying to access the woods behind a field house, but because there were students over there, he turned around and walked back through the parking lot to access the woods from another location. He was in the woods with Colleen for 25 uninterrupted minutes. Later, during the trial, prosecution pointed out that the instrument used to inflict the wounds was a plastic box cutter, where the exposed blade was only an inch in length. Chisholm would have had to sit and carve at her neck.
Jesus.
He returned to the school, now covered in blood. He went to his locker to grab his clothes, then he went to the bathroom to change. He returned to the crime scene once more to double check. He had left no evidence. Then he returned to the woods for a few more minutes. There, he rifled through Colleen's belongings, stealing her cards. Then he emerged, put his shoes on, and then he walked around the school again. After he left the school, he went to BJ's, where he stole a knife. Then he went to the movies using Colleen's credit cards. On November 21st, 2013, so a couple weeks later, Chisholm was indicted on charges of murder, aggravated rape, and armed robbery. He was arraigned on those charges on December 4th, 2014. Assistant District Attorney Kate McDougall, the blonde, tried Philip Chisholm as an adult, as was required by law. So the law in Massachusetts is people 14 and over are charged with murder, who are charged with murder are automatically tried as an adult in Massachusetts. Judge David Lowy was presiding and defense attorney Denise Reagan was representing Chisholm. That's Denise with the this one.
I'm curious to see what her defense is.
I feel like you'd probably take a guess.
Insanity?
Yeah. The trial was delayed during jury selection when Chisholm refused to enter the courtroom and told a psychologist that he was hearing voices and wanted to die. After a 20-day competency evaluation, the judge deemed him competent to stand trial, meaning he understood the charges against him and he could assist in his defense. During the evaluation at a state hospital in Worcester, Chisholm was diagnosed with a psychotic disorder and put on medication, according to his attorney. The trial began in late 2015. During this trial, his lawyer admitted Chisholm killed Ritzer, but said he was suffering from a severe mental illness and was not criminally responsible for his actions. A psychiatrist who testified for the defense said Chisholm was hearing voices and in the throes of a psychotic episode when he killed Colleen. They also argued... They also argued that Chisholm should be acquitted of the second rape in the woods because Colleen was already dead at that point.
It's not better. Isn't that a different thing? They're like, oh, well, he didn't rape her. It's just abuse of a corpse at this point.
Then, really?
Hey, fucking weirdos.
We literally
had a wild argument.
Videotape of like changing his clothes, taking her stuff.
He brought
like,
gloves.
Doing things that indicates premeditation or at least thinking it through. How are we even trying for insanity?
He
was walked in on and knew to move her body.
Yeah. To Lacey's point where she said he brought gloves, in this picture, he's checking his pocket to make sure that he has them.
He came in the hallway.
When you talked us through the video the first time and you said like you can see him here putting gloves on, I was like, we're going to be coming back to this because he brought those gloves with him.
Yeah.
You don't just walk around school with rubber gloves in your pocket.
He brought gloves. He brought a change of clothes.
He brought a ski mask.
Yeah.
He moved her when he almost got caught. He led the other kid away from the bathroom so that he wouldn't hear her call for help. Like, this was...
He grabbed
mental illness might have played a role. I was wondering. But, like, he knew what he was doing.
Yeah, I will say, though, that it was pretty ballsy the amount of times that he left her alone in the bathroom. Like, I don't know if he, like, hid her in a stall or, like, what. But, like, he attacked her. And then he left with her clothing, came back
alive in there,
grabbed all her bags and stuff, left, and then you ran into a friend and left again. Like,
it was big risky.
Yeah, big risky. Excellent. But then he also returned to the scene a couple times to make sure that he hadn't forgotten anything. So, yeah. So anyway, back to this. They were arguing that it wasn't rape, or the second rape charge shouldn't be applied because she was already dead. Prosecutors responded, saying the fatal stab wounds were not administered until she was brought outside. The prosecutors argued that it didn't make sense that Philip would rape Colleen after inflicting the gaping wounds to her neck. She also pointed out that Philip was only seen with a little blood on his person when he was moving through the hallways. So when he,
like when we saw it on his hand.
Yeah. Means too.
Only a little bit of blood on him right there. But then, I mean, he takes off his sweatshirt, and he's fine. If he'd inflicted the 16 neck wounds while in the bathroom, logic would say more blood would be on his person and also left in the bathroom.
Right.
Additionally, if he had inflicted wound D in the bathroom when he put her in the recycling bin, blood would have saturated her chest and top. Because gravity. The medical examiner said she couldn't say with certainty whether Colleen died in the bathroom or when Colleen died, and if it was before or after the rape with the branch. Judge Lowy rejected the defense's motion to drop the aggravated rape charge, saying that the attack in the bathroom and the woods were tied together through a unity of time, place, and circumstance, and there is uncertainty about whether the death preceded the alleged aggravated rape.
Thank you, Judge.
So, mm-hmm. defense was shut down in that case.
Because they were stupid.
So, as I said, the defense was insanity. Chisholm's family came out with supporting messages. Mental illness was to blame, as was teenagers being teenagers.
Oh,
you know how they are.
Kids. It's normal. It's normal.
I wasn't too mad about them claiming the mental illness, but like, you know, teens.
Would you like to know the
raping quote? And murdering their teachers?
That's putting, that's like the cousin of, oh, boys will be boys.
Yeah.
Terrence,
kids are kids, you know.
Terrence Chisholm, Blaine, Philip's uncle, told reporters that something may have provoked his nephew.
Yeah, she asked him about Tennessee. How dare she?
I really want to know, because I feel like this is just the beginning of quotes from his family that aren't great. Did anyone talk to him and be like, hey, maybe let's think this through about how you're going to be perceived, like, in a year or so?
I don't know. I just, so there aren't a ton of quotes. I have one from his uncle, his grandfather, and his mom.
So excited to hear them.
And that is the order of from bad to worse, or from bad to good.
Great.
I start off with the worst one. You ready for it?
Mm-hmm.
So Uncle Terrence, who said that his nephew was probably provoked, said, quote, he starts off with terrible grammar, quote, Mike could have been upset, you know, teenagers grow through that. He's 14. He's growing up still. That's the only thing that I can imagine. I can't imagine anything else because he's like a storybook kid. A perfect family.
That's not his true. I don't even know him, but I know that's not true.
His, what?
Yeah, I don't know if Terrence was really involved. But I did notice Chisholm is in that name, so I think that
the
dad's brother.
Mm-hmm.
So he might be a bit more forgiving about how dad's behavior may have affected it.
Do you think when the rest of the family saw that quote in the papers, they were like, why do they talk to Terrence?
He's the worst.
He doesn't even have anything to do with his family.
He lives in Tennessee.
He's never met Philip.
He's been calling him Pat for the last 8 years. It's the only other P name I could think of, Pat. Sorry. Philip's maternal grandfather, Eduardo Barbieri, was the defense's first witness. He testified that his ex-wife, Chisholm's grandmother, Joyce, suffered nervous breakdowns that began before Chisholm's mother, Diana, was born. She was repeatedly hospitalized, received electric shock therapy in 1975, and couldn't care for her three children. She actually had shock therapy many times, according to him. He continued saying that Chisholm's aunt also suffered mental breakdowns and required treatment at psychiatric hospitals. Quote, she couldn't handle anything, is how Barbieri described the breakdowns. Which
it was probably something like an anxiety attack or something. Yeah. And they just didn't know what to do back in the fucking 70s.
She couldn't handle anything. The car
absolutely shocked her brain.
In her cross-examination, prosecutor Kate McDougall forced Barbieri to admit that despite their mental illness, his wife and daughter never hurt anyone or even threatened to do so. I love Lacey or Bailey approving.
Mental illness doesn't mean that you're like you're violent. Like, don't blame right. all that shit.
Mm-hmm.
Like, are you
One
kidding?
One of my classmates also took the stand to describe Philip's behavior being friendly at first, but growing withdrawn in the weeks since his arrival at the school. Diana, however, released a statement saying her heart is broken for the Ritzer family and the loss of their daughter and sister, Colleen Ritzer, which I thought was very nice.
Yeah.
Considering.
That's just about all you really need to say if you're going to say anything.
Yeah.
Interestingly, on day 2 of the trial, the morning was spent giving testimony from police officers who described the scene and recycling bin found. After a short break, Kate McDougall planned to bring the bin into the courtroom. That was delayed because Philip refused to leave his holding cell. It was located just outside the courtroom. According to defense attorney Denise Reagan, Chisholm was twitching, mumbling, and saying he was about to explode.
Pick his ass up and carry him into the courtroom.
Just grab him by the ear and drag him in the fucking courtroom. Grow the fuck up, Philip.
These are consequences real of your quick. Actions. I gotta tell you a little story. My oldest told me that she hurt somebody at school the other day. And we were like, what happened? And she said that one of the boys in her class was stomping on her friend's doll. So she grabbed him by the ear and told him to stop.
That seems like an appropriate... We're not condoning. It feels like an appropriate amount of force.
Lewis was like, don't put your hands on other people. And I was like, I don't see what's wrong with that.
I'll probably remember it the next time I went to stomp on somebody's doll.
Yeah, that psycho was stomping on a baby.
Also, if anyone messes with her or any of my nieces or nephews, we want names.
I feel like you're not needed. She grabbed them by the ears.
She handled it.
We'll pick her up if you're busy at work.
Okay. So upon hearing how Philip was behaving, Judge Lowy took a recess to observe him himself. According to the judge, Chisholm was lying on the floor of the cell, muttering with his eyes closed, and he wouldn't respond to anyone's questions. It sounds like he's having a tantrum.
Yeah, I can also lie on the floor with my eyes closed and refuse to respond to questions. I fight the urge.
I mean, if you hold him to his throat, will that change his...
Yeah. Hmm. Switch up your strategy.
Eye for an eye.
So, Chisholm was given a battery of tests by the prosecution's expert psychologists, including an inkblot test, the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory for adolescents, the structured interview of reported symptoms, the Miller Forensic Assessment of Symptoms test, and the Dissociative Experiences Scale.
Jesus. I didn't know the inkblot test is actually, used.
Yeah. So, that one might fall into this category. Some of the tests can determine whether someone is faking good, which is making themselves look less sick than they really are, or faking bad, making themselves seem sicker.
Doctor, I'm glad that they have tests for that.
I don't know. I think, because it's like this.
She's glad that they have tests for that.
Oh, yeah.
I was going to let you keep going with what you're doing, though.
I thought you were like, how do they have tests for that? I was like, yeah. Lacey.
No, I like it, because I'm always like, how do they know if people are faking one way or another? They have ways to figure it out.
So Dr. Nancy Heben, who conducted most of the tests, concluded that Chisholm was
faking
bad, making himself seem worse.
Faking bad and a bad faker.
Experts testified that Chisholm was malingering, which means faking or exaggerating his mental illness.
Malingering. That's going to be my new word.
Yeah.
Good word.
I keep telling, side note, Pat gets annoyed with me because I started using peckish. I'm feeling peckish instead of hungry or starting to get hungry. And the last few times he's like, where the fuck did you find this word? Really annoying.
Why is he so angry?
Sound like a Victorian child.
like she has to use big words to make her feel smart.
It's not even that big of a word.
You just say I'm hungry. It's just simple.
Well, no, I'm getting hungry.
There's no mystery in that.
Bailey, you should pepper in some like heavily like British words to make yourself seem.
Could you send me a British word a day next year?
I'll try, yeah.
Or a month.
That's a lot of words.
Once a month.
You're going to be taking the lorry home. How about that?
Yes.
What is a lorry?
It's a, like a tractor trailer.
Hitchhike that.
Hello!
Perfect. You could call shopping carts trolleys.
The trolley?
Yep. Or you could just start calling your trunk the boot.
The boot!
I like the way she's practicing.
Yeah, those are just some quick words that I know off the top of my head. When you're around kids, you could like say, let's go change, or you should go change the nappy.
What's the word for rain boots? That
wellies.
I'm gonna get my wellies.
Perfect. So I didn't really have a good time to pepper in these from the trial, but here are some photos from the trial. That's the box cutter. That's as far as the blade will extend.
That's what he got into her neck with?
Yeah.
Oh, there's the whole trash can.
Mm-hmm. That's Colleen's shirt.
Ugh.
Those are his pants. I feel like you can probably figure out what that stuff is.
Yeah.
Sorry in advance for the next photo. Oh. And then we can stop with this for a sec. Closing arguments were given in December 2015. The jury deliberated for 9 hours. On December 15th, 2015, a jury found him guilty of first-degree murder, aggravated rape, and armed robbery. He was found not guilty of the second rape charge, which occurred with the tree branch. I'll explain. The jury wasn't convinced beyond all reasonable doubt that Colleen had been alive at the time. Before you say anything, Lacey, Massachusetts law requires a live victim to convict someone of rape. Unlike other states, Massachusetts doesn't have a law against abuse of a corpse.
Oh.
Yeah.
I just thought everybody did, I guess.
No, I'm learning recently that states have different laws, which feels stupid.
Well, because there's federal and then there's state law.
No, I know, but like I didn't know that they were so vastly different. I feel like
we're like the United States of America, but also not really.
Yeah.
We're like 50 different little countries.
And you should learn what your
know what the rules are where you are.
Exactly. Chisholm stared straight ahead and did not have any visible reaction as the verdict was read in Salem Superior Court. On February 26, 2016, the judge sentenced him to life in prison with the possibility of parole after 25 years for the murder of Colleen Ritzer and no less than 40 years for her rape and armed robbery.
So that 40 plus 25? Or
no, so from what I understand, for the murder, he can get parole after 25 years. But then for the rape and the armed robbery, he has to serve 40. So even after he hits the 25-year mark, he can't be paroled because he's still got those extra 15 years that he's got to do for the other two charges.
So how does he like serve the first couple years in juvie and then is transferred when he's 18? Or does he go right into jail?
Can I tell you?
Yeah.
Perfect.
I would love that.
So adults convicted of first-degree murder in Massachusetts automatically receive life without parole. But even though he was tried as an adult, following decisions by the U.S. Supreme Court and the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts, juveniles cannot receive life sentence without parole. So that's why he, even though it was first-degree murder, he is allowed to be paroled. While awaiting trial, you guys are going to love this. Ready? While awaiting trial, when Chisholm was 15, he was sent to Dorchester Department of Youth Services Detention Center. Okay. While there, he followed a female counselor into a locker room or a locker and bathroom area, and wielding a pencil as a weapon, attacked and seriously injured the 29-year-old clinician on June 2nd, 2014. Allegedly, he choked and beat the woman. Other employees came to her aid, and as Chisholm was pulled away, he yelled, "I'm going to kill them all."
Did she ask him about Tennessee?
Believe that he was provoked again.
The worker suffered injuries to her face, jaw, neck, and back. Chisholm took several steps to elude other staff who were believed to be observing him, including, but not limited to, creeping along a common hallway, crouched down, out of sight of observers, is what Kate McDougall said in the affidavit. He was arraigned in July for charges of attempted murder and assault and battery with a dangerous weapon. Bail for those charges was set at $250,000. So nothing happened with that until April 2024.
Sure.
10 years later.
Oh, that just happened. April
2024.
Yeah.
Well,
we were just there.
He was originally pleading not guilty, but then he changed his plea in April to guilty. The victim addressed the court through Assistant District Attorney David Bradley reading her statement. That's what he looks like now.
Looks like he could beat the shit out of you.
She said she is still haunted by Chisholm's face, the lack of emotion, just ready to kill. She called him a monster, and she fully believed he intended to kill her that day. The state requested a sentence of 15 to 18 years in the case, Bradley noting that there are very few juvenile defendants in the Massachusetts system with a behavior pattern this dangerous. Chisholm's attorney, Patrick Sparks, requested a sentence of 17 to 20 years, saying that his client wished to take responsibility of what he's done. Judge Helen Brown Bryant sentenced Chisholm to 17 to 20 years for the attempted murder charge and 9 to 10 for the other charges, to be served concurrently at Sousa Baranowski Correctional Center, a maximum security state prison. The sentence is to be served concurrent with his sentence for Colleen's murder.
Oh, so it's not even tacked on.
Yeah. I have very strong feelings about concurrent sentences. He's not
for violent shit like that. It doesn't even make sense. Why wouldn't you add that on and keep him away?
I also, for this in particular, because he's going to a maximum security prison or whatever, there's probably not going to be any women officers around him. So it's going to make it look like, oh, he's doing so well.
Good behavior also, bullshit.
I understand in some cases, like, with the whole, like, no, they, like, for juveniles getting, like, no parole, like, it not being fair, like, maybe they need time to, like, kind of grow up and think about what they've done. He doesn't care.
Violent shit like
literally this. Tried to do it again. Like,
right.
Colleen's siblings fully plan to do everything they can to make sure he never gets parole.
Good.
I agree. He committed two nearly identical attacks on nearly identical victims in 9 months.
Yeah.
Yeah. And when he did the second one, it wasn't like he was like out on bail or like he'd been set loose or anything. He was already in a place where he was like on lockdown. Like he was already dealing with consequences of what he'd done and he didn't care.
Yeah, Lacey, that was literally my next sentence. The fact that he did it in a detention center indicated to me that he has little control over this compulsion to attack women.
This is like serial killer, like
tendency. That's my next sentence. I think he has the makings of a serial killer.
Don't set him loose among us again.
And according to him, he doesn't have any morals. So
he's also like, I don't know how tall his defense attorney is in that other photo.
He looks gigantic.
He looks huge.
Well, remember when the cops saw him walking and he thought he was like in his early 20s?
Yeah, it's because he was so tall.
I don't like that.
No, me neither. Moving away from this man. To honor Colleen, her family established the Colleen E. Ritzer Memorial Scholarship to benefit graduating high school seniors who are Andover and Danvers residents, who demonstrate a passion for teaching and academic excellence and a love of family. Since its inception in 2013, the scholarship fund has awarded nearly $600,000. The funds are raised in various ways. So there's an annual Step Up for Colleen 5K walk/run that gives the proceeds to the fund. One could also buy Colleen's pink daisies, and proceeds go to the fund. There's one of her friends also started a Kindness for Colleen campaign, encouraging everyone to perform a random act of kindness in Colleen's. This alliteration is killing me.
You're doing a great
random
job.
Acts of kindness in Colleen's honor on October 22nd, and to share the acts of kindness on social media using the hashtag Kindness for Colleen. And the school made a Colleen Ritzer Memorial Garden in the library courtyard.
That's
nice. An attorney who was not involved in the case but gave an interview to reporters afterwards about the legalese, like they had questions, and he was like, "I'll answer." He said, "I thought it was really nice, so I wanted to say it." He said Colleen Ritzer was a young, vibrant woman killed in a place she loved and should have been safe by her own student. It was such a heartbreaking, horrific, monstrous thing to happen to such a wonderful young teacher. And she apparently did nothing, absolutely nothing, to deserve anyone even slightly disliking her. She asked about Tennessee. The difference Colleen made in such a brief period as a teacher was evident by the outpouring of kind and heartfelt testimonials following her passing, as hundreds of students participated in vigils, and other community events to commemorate and celebrate her life. A life defined by perpetual happiness and a light that can never be extinguished. Her passing forged tight bonds throughout the community in mourning and in celebration of the legacy of Colleen Ritzer. The end.
Okay, so Lacey, don't ask anyone.
Don't mention states.
All of the you have don't to build relationships talk. With your students is absolute bullshit, is what I'm hearing.
Just don't talk to any of your students.
Do not risk getting to know them.
Put a wall up.
I would just like, as soon as school ends, book it.
Or you could wear, like, one of those helmets the knights wear that, like, protect your throat, so that way, like, you can't get stabbed in the throat.
Any visible skin, just wrap armor around it.
Get a life alert. That way, if one of your kids attack you.
I'll have it go to, like, 6 different people's phones, so I know that somebody will hear a ping.
Preferably somebody close to you.
Yeah.
Physically close to you. Because if I got a ping, I'd be like, oh. What am I gonna do?
Hope she makes it.
You could also get air tags.
It's true. Keep them on me. I have Life 360, but that also requires my phone to be on me and working.
You should just get a life alert.
I like that. I like the life alert. Get it now, and then I won't have to fight it when I'm old because I'll be used to it.
You should get that thing where if you push it, it makes a really loud noise.
A personal alarm?
Yeah. Could you imagine if you were in a bathroom with somebody and you pushed it? You'd be deaf, but you'd be alive.
But so would they, and other people would hear it.
What did you say, Belle?
I said mace would also work as well.
Yeah, let's just get Lacey some self-defense stuff.
Okay.
I gotta be honest with you. I don't know that I would take that stuff to work.
Oh, boo.
How are you gonna protect yourself from...
I don't know.
Well, maybe I hope you enjoy hanging out with murderers all day, because apparently teenagers are teenagers.
Just being teens.
Mm-hmm. They just do that shit.
Okay.
What? Crazy.
What year did this happen again, Drew?
2014 or
2013. Okay.
We
were in college.
I was a teenager during that time, actually in high school. And I don't think I was going through that. No. And none of my peers were also going through that.
That you know of.
You didn't have, like, an urge.
Sounds like you had an atypical teen experience.
Hmm. According to Uncle Terrence.
I think the only...
I hope he has gout now.
The only weird death we suffered when I was in high school was a kid got hit by a train.
Oh.
And died. Yeah.
I figured.
Who?
Yeah, because she said a weird death. We weren't at
that same high school.
Yeah, but I also had a kid that got hit by a train and died.
There was one at my school. There was one at my school a couple years after I was out when my brother was there.
He got hit twice, actually.
That was an on-purpose kid.
I don't think I had anybody in my high school get hit with a train.
No train incidents?
No.
Why?
I had a car accident that was pretty bad. I don't think anybody died, though.
Yeah, no, maybe I know that, but no. Ours was, like, this, like, really sweet, like, Asian kid. He was, like, a dork. But he was really nice. He was in one of my gym classes.
I guess the moral of the story is...
Don't talk to people.
Don't trust teenagers.
Oh, I was just going to say, overall, everyone.
Youths.
I was just...
New activity.
Youths.
I was just so, like... I don't understand the people who try to get away with crime. Like,
I mean, it was such, like, a combination of him, like, trying to cover up and then immediately giving it all up.
My thing is, like, I'm trying to think, what exactly did he do that was, like, trying to cover up the murder?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I feel like he was kind of covering his face in school.
Yeah,
that's although that could have just been, like, a lot of teens walk around with their hoods up, too. So, like, maybe not so much. No, but
Lacey, he...
Check the hallway. Hold on.
Yeah.
He made an effort to...
Change his clothes.
It, like, the first time somebody walked in on him or he almost got caught, he didn't just, like, give it up. He was like, no, I'm not done with this yet.
What I think the first stupid thing he did was after she walked down the hallway, he came out without the hood on, looked both ways, walked into the classroom, then came back out with the hood up. Like, we know it's you.
No, we don't.
We just saw you.
Maybe someone else came into the classroom and changed clothes with him real quick.
So here's my question. So I feel that he planned something because, like we talked about, he had all the stuff he brought with him and whatever. I wonder if he planned specifically that he was going to kill her, or if it was more like, I'm going to hurt somebody.
Yeah.
And I'm going to have all this stuff and be ready for it. And he had the opportunity with her because he was able to stay after school with her. And then she, you know, said something and he was like, yeah, this is the time, I'm going to do it now. I just wonder if it was like her specifically or if it was a, I'm going to do it today to whoever it happens to.
Interesting.
I'm just not going to say anything to anyone ever again.
Why?
Because
you don't want to get murdered. I thought you meant us. I was like, no, what did we do?
I'm sick of this bullshit.
Yeah, I just like... Okay, so he removed the bags. Okay, so yeah, he wore gloves to cover for evidence, I guess. I don't know.
He's just getting very, like... impulsive, but also, like, I sort of planned it out, but also, like, I watched...
I think he watched one episode CSI and was like, I'm an expert, man.
Yeah, like, oh, yeah. Shit, like, I need to do this, like, if I'm gonna do it, like...
But then he just, like, left everything in one area. But then he smashed the table so that he couldn't be tracked.
It just gives all over the place, and, you know, boys mature slower, so he's just...
Also, I feel like we overlooked the fact that he walked, like, 5 miles.
Yeah, why didn't he just go home afterwards, too?
Because he was going to Canada,
he still
would have
been caught quickly, because the principal watched the footage that night. Like, they would have had him the next day, even if he went home, but, like... He was just out for a stroll, like he didn't have any next move planned.
No,
I feel like he was also, like, enjoying it.
He was going to Canada. Oh, remember the bridge?
I forgot he had a plan. The bridge to Canada.
But look, this is this little X is where the high school is, and this like area up here is where they found him.
I like, and also like he went back into the high school when there was no need to. I feel like that was like he was having the adrenaline rush doing it, not thinking, not getting caught immediately, and was just trying to like elongate the rush. Yeah.
Gross.
Yeah, you know, some people just ride roller coasters, but you know, whatever.
Teenagers will be teenagers.
Fucking kids.
Well, that was sinister.
We were sarcastic.
And we hope you keep listening.
Happy holidays!